Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Bruno Shirley, a co-host of this channel, and today we'll be talking to Alistair Gornall about his recent book, Rewriting Buddhism, Pali Literature and Monastic Reform, 1157 through 1270. Rewriting Buddhism is available to download open access at uclpress.com/Buddhism. Alistair, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Bruno. Thanks for having me on.
So I was hoping before we start talking about the book itself, you could just tell us a little about yourself. How did you come to be interested in Pali literature and eventually write this whole book about it?
Sure. So I think I first became aware of Theravada Buddhism and also Pali, its sacred language, as a late teenager. I think my dad, when I was about 16, 17, gave me some books by Dalai Lama and stuff. And that actually kind of changed my ideas about what I wanted to do at university. So I decided eventually to do religious studies at SOAS, University of London. And there in my first year, I had the good fortune to meet Kate Crosby, who is now a professor of Buddhist studies at King's College London. And, you know, she was offering these Pali classes. And, you know, it's kind of unusual in the sense that Kate basically, she offers these Pali classes and you don't need to know, say, Sanskrit before you take them. And so they were open to everybody. And so I joined it up fairly naive about what Pali was. And I think in that first year, I was definitely the worst student in that class. But, you know, I enjoyed the language. And so I decided to continue on doing it. And in my second year, I picked up Sanskrit with Whitney Cox, who's now at the University of Chicago, and a bit of Thai as well. Now, at that time, Kate was working on Sri Lankan Pali literature. And it was basically through her that I became interested in Sri Lankan Buddhism, in particular, its medieval history. And so I continued on at SOAS to a master's degree in the study of religion. And during this time, I was visiting India as well to study Sanskrit and Pali with a professor called Mahesh Deoka. And he's probably the greatest living expert in Pali literature today. And he was also an expert on Pali grammar, these traditional Pali grammars. And so I would see him in his classes, teaching these traditional Pali grammars, Kachayana, Moggallana. And at the time, I didn't really see what the interest was in these things. I didn't quite get it. But then when I returned to London, as part of a course, we visited the British Library, and we had a look at the Neville collection of Sri Lankan manuscripts. And so when I was looking at this catalogue, I realized there were these huge amounts of Pali grammars in this collection. And, you know, I was struck by, you know, why are there so many of these texts? So I wrote an essay on this collection and these manuscripts. And I came to discover that basically all of these Pali grammars were written in the 12th and 13th century Sri Lanka. And that they were basically little studied in the English language, at least. And I guess, you know, when at the time I was kind of excited by the idea that these texts had been so clearly so important to the Buddhist tradition, but that they were relatively little known about. And so I decided that I would like to kind of study them further, potentially, you know, when I was doing a PhD. But I soon came to realize that when reading these texts, you couldn't really understand what was going on without a knowledge of traditional Sanskrit grammar. And so I decided to leave London and went to do my PhD at Cambridge with Dr. Ivan Karth, who is an expert in Sanskrit grammar, but he's also written about Pali grammar and other traditional forms of South Asian hermeneutics, such as Nirukta, semantic analysis or etymology. And I ended up writing my PhD on these medieval Sri Lankan Pali grammatical texts. And I guess, you know, I was motivated to kind of answer two questions, really, in the PhD. So, you know, on the one hand, I was really trying to understand what is the relevance of grammatical literature to Buddhism, right? Why were scholar monks writing loads and loads of Pali grammars rather than, you know, writing commentaries on the suttas, on the Buddha's discourses? And then the second question I was really trying to answer was, you know, why specifically in the 12th and 13th centuries were these grammars written? You know, what was going on in Sri Lanka at that particular time that meant all this literature was written? And so with respect to like the second question, I guess it was probably about halfway through the PhD, I realized that actually if I was to answer that question at all adequately, I would, you know, it'd really require a kind of a more synthetic historical interpretation of all the Pali literature that was written in the 12th and 13th centuries. And so, you know, I came to realize that it wasn't just grammar that was new in this period, but there were new types of commentaries, new types of these kind of scholastic handbooks, poems, this ornate poetry, and also works on poetics as well. And so when I got a position in Singapore, I basically spent the next 5 years or more expanding this PhD to become the book, Rewriting Buddhism as It Is Now.
Well, that's a really great introduction to the book, and particularly perhaps the first section, which does focus heavily on grammatical texts. And I was wondering, before we get into the details of particular texts or authors, if you care to speak about the overarching narrative of the book, maybe the answers to those two questions that you came to realize were significant during your PhD, and perhaps also the significance of your section headings in the book. You've got these very evocative chaos, order, emotion divisions.
Sure, absolutely. So Rewriting Buddhism is essentially, it's an intellectual history of Theravada Buddhism and its Pali literature in 12th and 13th century Sri Lanka. And this period, it's kind of remembered for a number of reasons. So principally, it is the era in which the monastic community in Sri Lanka was reunified during the reign of Parakramabahu I, who ruled between 1157 and 1186. And in early English language histories, he's often referred to as Parakramabahu the Great. And for much of the history of Theravada Buddhism in Sri Lanka, the monastic community was split into three different groups, or fraternities, if you will. The Mahavihara, the Abhayagiri, and the Jetavana. And so the first split occurred in the first century BCE. And then the second split, where the Jetavana was formed, occurred in the third century of the Common Era. And so this divided monastic community essentially continued for more than 1,000 years, I guess, until 1165, when Parakramabahu, this great king, oversaw the reunification and reform of the monastic community. And so this is the main reason I refer to this period in the book as Sri Lanka's reform era, because towards the end, about 100 or so years later, you have a couple of other kings who, in a sense, try to replicate what Parakramabahu did, but certainly not on the same scale. And after this unification in 1165, Buddhist monks, they produced a huge amount of Pali literature, principally. And so when we look at all the Pali literature that was composed in Sri Lanka and South India for much of its history, you know, this era accounts for about a third or perhaps even more, maybe even a half, of all the Pali literature that was ever written. And so, you know, taking into account the thousands of years history that of Buddhism in Sri Lanka, you know, just in this 100 years, you essentially get about a third or half the Pali literature written, at least in terms of works composed in Sri Lanka and South India. And as I said before, you know, this literature was very diverse, and these monks were writing in new genres, which they had never written in before, these new types of grammar, history, poetry, commentary, that kind of thing. And this period is also, I guess, remembered because it is the era in which monks from Sri Lanka, they traveled to Southeast Asia, and they established lineages there. And similarly, you get some monks coming from Burma, traveling to Sri Lanka too. And when they returned back to Southeast Asia, they brought these Sri Lankan monastic lineages as well. And so, you know, this period, in a sense, we can think of it as the beginning of Theravada Buddhism as a trans-regional formation, you know, encompassing Sri Lanka, parts of South India at that point, and Southeast Asia. And, you know, when we look at the monastic curricula in the region today, what we might kind of call the Theravada world, monks are still very much focused on studying the texts which were composed during this reform era in Sri Lanka. And so these works still very much remain authoritative in monastic curricula today. Now, when we look at and what historians, you know, have said about this period, essentially, see, you know, historians have tried to explain this area or this era of cultural productivity as simply a product of the 30-year reign of Parakramabahu I. So Parakramabahu, you know, he was this great, powerful king who conquered the whole of the island, and he welded it together through physical force and you know, centralized power very much. And historians have argued that essentially his reign created this kind of peace and tranquility in which monastic community could simply engage in religious works, in scholarly writing, simply for the fact that they weren't disturbed. And so for this reason, you know, historians have referred to this as Sri Lanka's Augustan Age, drawing parallels with Roman and Latin literary history. But then when I came to look at the details of the period, I realized that this narrative was actually only partially true. So in fact, you know, Parakramabahu the first reign was an exception to the more general trend towards political fragmentation and localization on the island. So what do I mean by that? So before and after his rule, there were these bitter civil wars between rival royal factions. And in the 50 years that followed his reign in particular, there were around 16 kings and queens to take the throne. And so each of these kings and queens, you know, they didn't actually rule much of Sri Lanka. Their power was relatively limited. And so essentially Sri Lanka was ruled by this kind of interesting bunch of characters, but none of which, you know, none of whom, you know, they actually governed much of the island. And I found when I looked into the Pali literature and I was looking at to when it was written, I found that most of the Pali literature produced during this period was actually a product of this era of turmoil rather than the stability of Parakramabahu's reign. And so, you know, I began to question whether essentially it was right to interpret this era of cultural productivity only as this byproduct of stability, while essentially ignoring the more chaotic character of the period either side of his rule. And I found too that the unification and reform of the monastic community, while Parakramabahu, he oversaw the event of the reform in 1165. The actual process of reform had begun before Parakrambahu's reign, and it also continued afterwards, but without necessarily having any royal supervision. So in the years after his reign, again the monastic community, for instance, it increasingly styled itself as an independent royal court with a king-like figure known as the Grand Master or Mahasami. And its own hierarchy, I guess, became completely, very complex. And the monastic community cultivated a kind of organizational autonomy that essentially allowed it to survive this political upheaval. And so this is why I characterize this context of the whole book as chaos, because what I'm trying to do is essentially direct people's attention to these periods either side of Parakrambahu's rule, which I feel the monastic community was primarily responding to in its desires for reform and its desire for this kind of era of cultural productivity. And so when I came to read the writings of the monks of this period, I also found that the monks themselves saw the works that they were writing as a kind of response to perceived disorder in their religious tradition, rather than any form of stability. And they were really motivated to control the chaotic social and political forces that had destabilized their community prior to Parakrambahu's reign, and then again afterwards. So in this sense, monastic literature, it wasn't simply a kind of byproduct of politics in the way it had been described previously, but I was trying to show in the book that essentially that monastic literature itself was highly political. It was a kind of intervention by monks to reshape their circumstances. So, in the book, I distinguish two overlapping sides to this political engagement, which I write about in the two sections you mentioned, order and emotion. So on the one hand, monks, they wrote to better unify monastic behavior and practice. In a sense, Pali literature formed a kind of organizational plane on which they could think, arrange their thoughts and ideas. And, they also wrote to standardize monastic education, which was, key in constituting the monastic community's new, more autonomous political hierarchy. And so that is kind of what I mean by order. And then on the other hand, they wrote these great works of literature address the kind of more localized politics of the period. They were trying to establish these emotional, devotional ties with these minor princes and kind of smaller warlords who dominated Sri Lanka's political landscape after Parakrambahu. And also these literary works, they were employed to strengthen the effective ties of their own religious community as well, right? So in a sense, emotion was this ability to also order society, but in a slightly different way to the kind of organization of ideas by expanding this emotional community. They could, in a sense, secure their patronage from smaller rulers, but they also could consolidate their own coherence as a community. And so from this perspective, essentially, I argue that this unprecedentedly productive literary period, right, this period of literary efflorescence in Sri Lanka's history, it was basically it was as much about the monastic community trying to survive amidst a kind of period of political fragmentation and chaos, maintaining its unity, expanding its power, as it was about, the supposed peace and tranquility of Parakrambahu's rule, in essence.
And with such dramatic stakes, how do we fit in grammar? Like, what is at stake in grammar here? What do we learn more generally from paying attention to these grammatical texts that you initially started this project working on?
That's a great question. So Pali grammar was really important for the monastic community. In its attempts to maintain that monastic unity and to fight the forces of perceived religious decline. So, to understand why, it's important to first note that the Buddhist tradition, had long believed in a kind of ontological connection between the state of the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma, and the social and moral state of the world, right, or the cosmos. So traditionally, Buddhists have believed that the world is kind of inevitably marching towards degeneration and decline. And the Buddha's teachings too are, they're supposed to only last for 5,000 years, and their deterioration, it kind of conditions this societal and cosmological collapse. And so to preserve the Buddha's teachings is to, in many ways, postpone and maybe even temporarily reverse this process. So essentially, the Buddhist tradition is in constant decline, and it will only last 5,000 years. And, by the time you get to the end of those 5,000 years, nirvana is essentially impossible. And once, Buddha's teachings disappear, the cosmos undergoes a kind of existential collapse as well, finally being subsumed into this inferno or floods or hurricanes, this kind of thing. And so this sense of decline was certainly heightened during the reform era. And monks in their writings, they often frame their scholarly interventions in these cosmological terms. So prior to the reform era, though, this kind of practice of conserving the Dhamma, protecting the Dhamma, it basically manifested in the writing of commentaries on the Pali Canon, because essentially the Pali Canon was the Dhamma, right? The Tipitaka, it was their most sacred scriptures. But during the reforms, a new idea emerged that actually, the first line of defense of the Dhamma was not necessarily writing commentaries on the wording of the Pali Canon, but it was actually to care for the language, or to care for the grammar of the language that those scriptures were written in. So monks became particularly concerned with what they saw as like the underlying order of the Pali language. Its grammatical structure. And so, there's some evidence in these grammatical writings that they actually blamed the previous grammatical scholarship for the kind of confusion and disorder that their religious tradition had found itself in. And so, as part of this idea that grammar was somehow the foundation of textual order, and therefore based on this homology between language and social and moral order, grammar was also the foundation of, in a sense, the cosmic order. They were looking for new models of grammatical scholarship that they thought were kind of superior to the ones that had failed them. And so they turned to models from the Sanskrit tradition, which they saw as kind of more expressive of a ideal form of linguistic order. So it's kind of perhaps important to note here that they these monks, they weren't writing in Sanskrit. They were experts in Sanskrit. They knew Sanskrit very well, but they never used Sanskrit to, say, explicate the Buddha's teachings. But what they were interested in was essentially the Sanskritic idea of language. And they wanted to show that Pali was as much language as Sanskrit was language. And so they used Sanskritic techniques of linguistic analysis to show this. And so they created these new grammars for Pali on the basis of these Sanskrit antecedents. essentially, you know, with the understanding that they were creating a better ordered foundation for the study of their scriptures, but also fundamentally for their religious tradition and also for their society as a whole. Now, in many ways, you know, this idealized connection between grammatical order and societal order was already present in the Sanskrit tradition, especially the Sanskrit court cultures of India. You know, kings in India would patronize the production of Sanskrit grammars. They would author Sanskrit grammars, again, based on the similar idea that the person who masters language also masters the world, based on this ontological connection between the two. And so similarly, you know, in the reform monastic community, most of the Pali grammatical scholarship from the reform era was composed by the monastic community's own leader, the Grand Master or Mahasami. As again, you know, it was the principal foundational discipline for actively maintaining both textual and social order. And so it was essentially, you know, the responsibility of the political leader, right? So in this case, the Grand Master in the monastic community.
And that Grand Master would also be involved, I suppose, then in this sort of blossoming of exegetical literature you document in the following chapters, right? Commentaries, sub-commentaries, anthologies. Are similar processes going on there? What did these authors understand themselves to be doing?
Sure, yes, absolutely. So, I mean, in many ways, the composition of exegetical literature during the period, so we're talking about commentaries, handbooks, and anthologies, their production essentially followed a similar logic to the production of grammar, you know, in that all of these works were in some way attempting to preserve the Buddha's teachings. And so we see, you know, similar changes in the methods of commentaries, handbooks, and anthologies that we do in grammar, based in part, again, on the application of Sanskritic or Sanskrit exegetical practices. So to give an example, you know, commentaries, they become increasingly detailed and systematic. These handbooks and anthologies, what we begin to see is the use of contents lists, referencing explicit kind of citations and also kind of rudimentary forms of bibliography as well. And, you know, there are two related reasons for this. So first of all, you know, the monastic community, you know, it has standardized monastic education, and monastic schools were the foundation on which the community's structural hierarchy was based. So these formal changes in, you know, that we see in these commentaries, they were essentially, you know, they were part of the birth of scholasticism in Buddhism in Sri Lanka. And they reflect the needs of the late medieval school system. And so, for instance, in the commentaries, you'll have, you know, very systematic order of exegesis, analyzing words in terms of their meaning, their grammatical senses, and they'll be included in all of these texts, a kind of question and answer, which will in many ways replicate what you could imagine was going on in the kind of classrooms of these schools, which formed the basis of the monastic hierarchy. But, you know, behind all of that, behind these practical considerations of, you know, there is always this more metaphysical idea that these new textual approaches would bring greater order to the Buddha's teachings and also to then to the society around them. You know, alongside, I guess, this greater systematicity in these works, we see other developments in the exegetical literature of the period. One of which is that these texts, you know, they begin to move away from older, more formal ideas of scriptural authority. So traditionally, ultimate religious authority, it resided in the literal wording of the Buddha's discourses as preserved in the Pali canon or the Tipitaka, right? And so a lot of the exegetical work before this period, it's, you know, Pali literature is basically writing commentaries on the wording of the canon. you know, we get some histories of the monastic community as well, but the majority of literature is simply just writing commentaries on the Pali Canon. But then as we move into this reform era, we see that exegetical attention, it largely moves away from commenting on the canon. And so a lot of these commentaries that are being composed, they're being written to support this study of these school handbooks. And the handbooks and the anthologies too, you know, they're not only based on the Pali Canon anymore, but they're basically these works which synthesize the commentarial literature that had developed around the canon and essentially all the monastic writings that had happened in the preceding 1,000 years. But the interesting thing is that the you know, when these monks are writing these new anthologies, they still state, you know, as if they were the old type of commentator, they still state that they're preserving the Buddha's teachings. But rather than, you know, saying that they are going to preserve the wording of these teachings, they all focus on the fact that they are preserving what they call its essential meaning, this in Pali, this sara atta. And so in the rhetoric of these exegetes, we see a shift in focus away from a concern with the literal wording of their scriptures towards essentially what we can kind of think of as an interest in representing the meaning of the Buddhist tradition in new forms, but still saying that they are preserving the Buddha's teachings. And so, you know, this kind of shift in the practice of conservation, it allowed them, you know, greater flexibility in tailoring Buddhist doctrines and practices that were more suited to their environment, right? So to give an example, in one of these anthologies, essentially during the Reform era, we see a new practice begins to emerge of worshipping the Dhamma as a relic. And so we start to get shrines to the Dhamma, as well as, you know, we in the old tradition, you would have still shrines to the Buddha. Buddha relics would be enshrined in stupas. But now we start to get scriptural texts enshrined in stupas. And this caused a legal problem, essentially, in the Sangha, because there was an economic question here, whether the wealth of these shrines to the Dhamma could be able to be transferred to the shrines to the Buddha and vice versa, whether the wealth was transferable. And so in one of these anthologies, you know, this in one of its principal chapters deals with this issue. And this, you know, in a commentary on the actual literal text of the monastic discipline, this issue, you know, is buried deep in a very obscure part of the Vinaya. But allowing these processes of compilation, of abstraction, you know, allowed these monks to take issues which were more meaningful to their monastic community and put them at the forefront of their works, but still saying that they are preserving this essence of the Buddha's teachings, even though they have, you know, moved quite far away from any relevance really to what is in the actual literal wording of the Vinaya. So, you know, in a sense, I would say, just to sum up, you know, they could use, they were better able to use a variety of sources, you know, and not just the literal text of their scriptures. But at the same time, what's important is that they still claimed the authority of representing the meaning of the Buddha's teachings.
That's absolutely fascinating. Definitely the most interesting explanation of a legal problem I've heard in quite a while. In the third part of the book, you turn to aesthetics, sort of almost Sanskritic aesthetics, in the pursuit of what I think you call at one point karmically transformative emotions. And I think as well you make the point that this is not the Ashvaghosha style, you know, a spoonful of sugar to help the Dharma go down, but something that is, aesthetics is important in their own right. Would you mind elaborating on that a little or explaining what's happening in that section?
Sure, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, the you know, during this period, you know, we in the Reform era, we get these new literary works, which are very ornate. And again, you know, they're modeled on the Sanskrit tradition. But, you know, whereas, say, you know, the Sanskrit Buddhist, you know, Buddhist writing in Sanskrit in India, you know, had long been using this very ornate style of literature. You get someone, as you mentioned, you know, such as Ashvaghosha, who essentially uses court literature as a kind of Trojan horse in which, you know, to entertain a king, but at the same time to smuggle in some Buddhist doctrine at the same time. But the Pali, the context in Sri Lanka is very different. So it has a lot to do with changing attitudes to emotion in the reform era. So, you know, a thread running through a lot of this literature is a turn towards more devotional practices. Now, the theorization of devotion in the anthologies, for instance, is often, you know, it's often framed similarly to the commentaries within traditional ideas about cosmological decline. And, of course, you know, there is this very real backdrop of the social and political turmoil that a lot of these monks were writing in. And this focus on devotion, this shift towards devotion in the literature of the era, it essentially reflects this idea that, you know, nirvana was increasingly difficult to achieve. Buddhism had declined to such an extent that maybe liberation was no longer possible, or at least there were more limits on human freedom in being able to achieve liberation, and you need some help to do that. And so, you know, monks started to focus a lot more, at least, you know, openly on heavenly rebirths as a goal. And in particular, some elites, at least a lot of these authors that I was dealing with, they aim now to be reborn as Buddhas in the distant future. So these, you know, these devotional practices that they were engaged in, they center on basically cultivating favorable emotions. In particular, this emotion called pasada, which is loosely we can kind of call it a serene joy. And they were aiming, you know, devotion involved cultivating this emotion in relation to the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, the monastic community. And these emotions were considered to be karmically transformative in that experiencing them was thought to kind of condition massive beneficial results, right? Such as a heavenly rebirth or creating a pathway to Buddhahood in a distant future, for instance. So in one of these stories that is quite, which we find in this period, you have the story of this owl where the Buddha is teaching his monks and this owl comes and he flies down and lands at the Buddha's feet and he kind of prostrates to the Buddha and folds his wings, supposedly in anjali. And this owl experiences this pasada, this serene joy. And the Buddha then says to this monk, he says, you know, look at this owl. Because this owl is experiencing joy in my presence, he is basically, this owl has set in motion a karmic chain of events that will lead it eventually to become a Buddha. And he said, this owl will become the Buddha Somanasa. And so, you know, this kind of shows the power of these emotions. So in the chaos of this reform era, right, you know, this focus on emotion, it led monks to experiment with new forms of devotional practice, because essentially, you know, it sounds weird, but these monks were pleasure seekers, right? They were seeking out these spiritual pleasures, which were somehow incredibly transformative for them karmically. And so they were finding new ways of doing this, you know, finding new ways of achieving this pasada. So one of the ways that they did it is through the experimenting with new forms of poetry. And it's worth saying here that you know, prior to this period, the Theravada Buddhist tradition, you know, had been, you know, and you know, apathetic or perhaps even hostile to ornate poetry, in particular Sanskritic ornate poetry. And so, you know, I think it's in the Brahmajala Sutta, the Buddha, you know, he famously refers to poetry, and I guess we have to think of Sanskrit poetry here as bestial knowledge. But the difference, you know, in the reform era is essentially, you know, this poetry, scholar monks start to use this Sanskrit court poetry to produce new forms of devotional literature to the Buddha that could inspire this pasada, these devotional sentiments. And to facilitate this, they kind of manifest. They wrote these new manuals for poetry, which essentially turned this courtly eloquence into a moral practice, leading towards this devotional goal. And they also wrote new Buddha biographies and these devotional histories of the Buddha's relics as well. Now, it's important to stress that, you know, this literature was not simply a vehicle for personal transformation, right? It was composed to instill devotional sentiments throughout elite society. And so, you know, these works were highly political. There wasn't really a distinction between devotion and politics here, because they were aiming to cultivate within political elites these feelings of devotion, and they're wanting to turn these elites into Buddhist devotees and therefore strengthen the monastic community itself, and also internally in the monastic community, right? So, you know, this literature essentially turned the monastic community into an effective community. Devotional literature allowed these monks to simultaneously experience these emotions, and it also consolidated this monastic community, just in the same similar ways that, you know, standardizing monastic discipline or standardizing some doctrinal ideas may create monastic coherence. Shared emotions as well were very much important in creating the coherence necessary for monastic reform. Emotions as well as ideas were very, very very political.
So I'm very interested, and this is, I appreciate quite a general question, but one I'm sure you've put a lot of thought into over the last 5 years. But I'm very interested in the selection criteria that you used. You have these six scholar monks in particular you focus on throughout the book. How did you narrow it down to these six monks, these six works as well, and not others? So there are, I suppose what I'm really asking is, are there texts or authors you had to cut for brevity that maybe didn't quite make it in this book?
Yes, so it was a hard decision, actually, which text to include. But actually, originally when I was writing the book, I hadn't intended for parts 2 and 3 to actually be structured around specific case studies. I had wanted to talk in more general terms about the literary developments of the period, particularly in terms of genre. And so I actually started, there are a few draft chapters on my hard drive, which simply just talk about the genre as a whole, you know, commentary or poetry. But I found that approach, it became a little bit too abstract, and I couldn't quite get into the heads of the monks in a way, if you see what I mean, in the way that I wanted to. And so, I decided to focus on these six case studies, choosing six texts, while trying at least, you know, in most of these chapters to draw out some general developments that could apply to almost any text in that genre. And even when I was focusing on the specific details of a particular text, I still kind of kept in mind the idea that I was trying to tie some of these details to other developments in the period across genres. But in terms of, you know, choosing the texts, I guess, I chose texts that I thought best represented their genre. And I was focusing on the texts that I thought were the most influential during the period, that had the biggest impact on Pali literary history, not only in the reform era, but actually, you know, I kept in mind as well that the history of Theravada Buddhism as a whole. So, you know, there's, you know, like the Jhanalankara, you could argue, actually, in Sri Lanka, this is a Buddha biography. Sorry, this biography of the Buddha. It was an important text, but it wasn't necessarily as important, perhaps, as some other works. But at the same time, it had a huge impact in Southeast Asia. So, you know, sometimes I would be nudged towards a particular text because of its impact on the tradition as a whole, and not just the reform era. But the main focus was on the impact and its importance in the reform era. And I guess the other consideration I had was the interest and the patience of my readers, right? So, in the grammatical and commentarial chapters, I'm dealing with quite complex stuff. These complex intellectual changes. You know, after all, we're dealing with scholasticism in these chapters. And so, in the chapter on anthologies, I wanted to choose a doctrinal anthology rather than one on monastic discipline. So I was thinking maybe of doing this handbook on the Vinaya, on the monastic discipline, the Vinaya Sangaha, because it was really important and influential. But I ended up moving to this doctrinal handbook simply because I thought, you know, after some grammar and commentary, it might be a bit dry to then go to some kind of very technical problems in the Vinaya. But in any case, it kind of worked out because the doctrinal anthology, the Sarasangaha, you know, is useful as this work is a kind of manual for those who are aspiring to Buddhahood. And so it had a lot of theory about devotion and emotion that linked well to the final part of the book on emotion. But in terms of texts I didn't manage to look at, I would really have liked to look at the Chulavangsa as a literary work. So this is a history of the monastic community. And part of this text, at least the text part which was written during my period, this reform era, it narrates the history of the reign of Parakrambahu I in a very ornate literary fashion. And, you know, this history of Parakrambahu is written probably a couple of decades after his rule, during the civil war. And it you know, it celebrates his political power and his might and his role as a great patron of Buddhism. And I think this eulogistic kind of recollection of Parakrambahu's reign, it serves as a useful reminder, which I'm not sure, you know, I emphasized enough in the book, that, you know, even though the monks, they made the best of this turmoil, and they did well, you know, in this era of political fragmentation, you know, they still very much longed for an age of political consolidation, where the community could depend on say a single munificent king. And so in a sense then, I think we can, you know, I can say that these monks were somewhat reluctantly autonomous, right? And they never really lost the sense that Buddhism was best with a strong centralized royal support. And this, you know, you could potentially contrast this with the parallel developments in late medieval Europe, right, where, in a sense, the church was more assertively separating itself from what was considered to be secular power. You know, in terms of the autonomy that these two traditions carved out for themselves, you know, we can talk about these in a kind of comparative, on a comparative basis. But I would say the difference, the main difference is, you know, the Buddhist tradition really never, you know, it always was hoping that a new monarch would come along to centralize things again, you know, like Ashoka or someone like that. And so even though the monastic Sangha, you know, it was autonomous, it had its own king essentially in the form of the Grand Master, and it was functioning very well by itself, you know, in their writings, these monks very much were longing for the days of Ashoka, where a king would oversee the Buddhist tradition as a great patron, basically.
Well, thank you so much for talking us through those arguments. It's I can say from personal experience, it's a fascinating book, and I hope a lot of our listeners are inspired to read them in more detail. Just as we wrap up, I was hoping I could ask you sort of the traditional question on the podcast. What is it that you're working on now that this book is finally out there?
Sure. So I'm currently working on a new book, tentatively called Buddha Worlds. So this is a history of Theravada Buddhist cosmological and ecological thought. So in many ways, actually, you know, it's kind of a continuation of the things I couldn't write about in rewriting Buddhism. You know, a lot of it is still relevant to that particular period. So, you know, this focus on cosmic decline, devotion, the path to Buddhahood, you know, that we find in the Reform era, this led in the monastic writings to a great deal of cosmological speculation, describing like the intricacies of the universe and the relationships of the living beings within it. And this really kicks off in a big way in Southeast Asia too. So, you know, while we see this in Sri Lanka in the Reform era, as these monastic lineages spread to Southeast Asia, monks in northern Thailand and Burma, they began to write these long treatises on the cosmos or the loka, the world. And, you know, again, all of these texts are fairly neglected, at least in English language scholarship. And I guess my book is, you know, this book at the moment, I'm envisaging it as essentially a sketch of a larger history of Theravada Buddhist ideas about the world, the loka, from the canon all the way to maybe the 19th century. And I guess another motivation for doing this is this kind of wider debate that is happening about the compatibility of Buddhist thought and environmentalist thought. And so since the 1970s, historians and scholars of religion, right, they've been debating whether our current climate crisis, whether it owes its origins in some respects to medieval Christian theological ideas about the natural world. And then, you know, in contrast with this, you know, you've had some scholars who've presented Buddhism, at least in theory, as a tradition compatible with modern environmentalism. But these debates, you know, especially in relation to Theravada Buddhism, they basically focus on the same ancient texts, the suttas of the Pali canon. And they've basically ignored what later Buddhists in history wrote about the natural world. So, you know, I'm hoping to fill in that gap and work out, you know, how did Buddhist ideas about nature change over time. But, you know, I've only just started working on this work. So you'll have to give me another 5 to 10 years before we can talk about it in more detail.
Well, if the podcast is still running in 5 to 10 years, I'll hope that we will meet here once again. That sounds like a fascinating and very timely book.
Thank you, Bruno.
Well, look, thank you so much for your time, Alistair. Until next time.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.